Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska, who critically assesses the U.S. Supreme Court's intervention in the five-week-long post-election dispute. Ted Glick, national coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network, who describes a national pro-democracy campaign motivated by this year's contested presidential election. And Barbara Briggs of the National Labour Committee, who talks about her group's current campaign to support fired union workers at the Chentex clothing factory in Nicaragua. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Brazil's prisons have long been notorious for brutalizing inmates. Now, a former prison doctor has written a best-selling book telling horrific tales of prison squalor, violence, and disease. Despite inquiries by Amnesty International and the Organization of American States, Brazil's prison conditions are only getting worse. There are over 220,000 people waiting in detention centers, and riots and escape attempts at these centers occur nearly every day. Up to this point, Brazil has tried to build itself out of the prison crisis. This year, the state government in Sao Paulo has constructed 3,800 new prison beds, but there are 6,700 new prisoners waiting to fill the cells. During a recent tour of Brazilian prisons, Sir Nigel Rodney of the United Nations Commission for Human Rights endorsed the call to change prison sentencing. He called prison conditions subhuman and complained of violent, arbitrary, and corrupt behavior among prison guards. The Roman Catholic Church in Brazil claims that upwards of 70% of the inmates could be freed. Significant numbers of prisoners are behind bars for minor drug and robbery offenses. In October, the Brazilian national government encouraged the creation of community service programs for prisoners. Finally, Brazil may be shamed into creating humane conditions for tens of thousands of prison inmates. The New Internationalist magazine reports that gay rights are now integrated into South African law. It started 6 years ago, when the African National Congress pushed through the groundbreaking Equality Clause, which banned discrimination based on sexual orientation into South Africa's new constitution. That was just the beginning for gay and lesbian South Africans. In contrast to neighboring countries Zimbabwe and Namibia, South Africa has continued to expand legal rights for gays and lesbians, at times surpassing the progress made in many European nations. In cases brought by the National Coalition for Gay and Lesbian Equality, the South African Constitutional Court decriminalized gay sex in 1997, and the court has granted permanent residency status to same-sex partners. In addition, gay rights advocates in South Africa have won domestic partner benefits, the freedom for gays to serve in the military, and legal protection in cases of domestic violence. Still, gays living in poor rural districts fear being victims of violent attacks and rape. Each year, the Gay and Lesbian Legal Advice Center handles over 600 cases of complaints, ranging from violations of employment rights to domestic violence. In recent years, the legal center has had trouble getting private funding to defend gay rights. But the center serves as a model for other African nations, as it is the continent's only gay legal rights organization. In early December, after 10 years of detailed scientific review of leaking hazardous PCBs, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced a plan to force General Electric to dredge 40 toxic hotspots in the upper reaches of the Hudson River, near where the industrial giant legally dumped PCBs or polychlorinated biphenyls for 30 years. The EPA cleanup plan, one of the largest in American history, is a major victory for New York environmentalists, who for nearly 20 years have pushed for dredging PCBs out of the Hudson River. As a result of the PCB pollution, New York State has severely restricted fishing in the Hudson, and the EPA has designated 200 miles of the river below GE's plants as a federal Superfund site. The EPA cleanup plan will take 5 years to complete and cost GE $460 million. A final cleanup order is expected in June 2001. For its part, GE is ready to fight the dredging plan with all the clout and money that the multi-billion-dollar corporation can muster. Many environmentalists worry about GE's clout if Republican George W. Bush is sworn in as the next president. Andy Mealy of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, a group founded by Pete Seeger over 30 years ago, fears that GE could still shirk its cleanup responsibility by cutting a backroom deal with a Bush White House. Mealy concluded, "GE will play hardball. I think it is going to get ugly. Let's face it, a Bush EPA will cave." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
By issuing a stay of Florida's high court ruling to hand count ballots in all of the state's 67 counties, the U.S. Supreme Court has taken on the responsibility of making the politically charged decision as to who will serve as the nation's next president. The partisan nature of the Supreme Court's preliminary decision to halt the vote count was evident in the breakdown of the 5-4 decision. Concerns about conflicts of interest among the Supreme Court's conservative justices in making this historic ruling emerged in several press accounts. Justice Clarence Thomas's wife was engaged in gathering resumes for appointments in a future Bush administration as part of her work for the Heritage Foundation, a longtime Republican Party ally. An earlier report revealed that Justice Antonin Scalia's son Eugene was a partner in a law firm representing the Bush campaign before the Supreme Court. The New York Daily News also presented an account in which Scalia threatened to leave the court if a Democrat were to win the presidency because he would have no chance at being named Chief Justice by Al Gore. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with former U.S. Senator Mike Gravel, who represented Alaska in Congress from 1969 to 1981. The senator, an energetic advocate for environmental protection and arms control in Washington, critically assesses the Supreme Court's intervention in the 5-week-long post-election dispute.
They've made a mistake from day one in injecting themselves into what is essentially a political matter. And the court historically has always tried to avoid political questions, leaving that to the people and the legislatures in question. And so their injection is going to do damage to the credibility of the court. If they render a 5-4 decision terminating everything and George Bush becomes the president, this will forever color the partisan nature of the Supreme Court. Ideologues who really worship the court like to say, well, it's not a partisan issue, it's an ideological issue. Well, of course, that's just another word for partisan, unfortunately. What's embarrassing for Bush is that he's in a position of saying, let's not count the votes and let's use whatever legal chicanery is possible to effect a final decision in my favor. I think, unfortunately, this will cast a cloud over his presidency. He will be damaged goods, and with the way the Congress is going to be gridlocked, we're going to see the next 4 years, probably the worst 4 years of any presidential administration in history.
Aside from the propaganda and who an individual might want to be president of the United States, and it seems like people's opinions on the court case really, you know, divide right along who they want to sit in the White House. But to not count votes, it's eerie to me that so many people are buying the argument that counting votes is somehow wrong.
Well, and what they're trying to use as a standard is that there's an imperfect standard in counting the votes. Well, there was an imperfect standard in machine voting. There's an imperfect standard in all of this. And so their criteria that we shouldn't count the votes because it's going to be done on an imperfect standard, I think is just ridiculous because the whole process has been on an imperfect standard. And so what you do is you do the best you can. And in this particular instance, they were going to have a single judge supervise the standard for the entire count. Now, I can't think of any better process than that.
If the Supreme Court should make the decision that the count will stop permanently and that, by default, George W. Bush, the certified winner of the 25 Florida electoral votes, will become the next president. Will those votes ever be counted that are locked away in Tallahassee at this point?
Yes, they will. And I understand the newspaper down in Florida is intent on doing that. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of scholars and academics that want to do this and write books about it. If the court did that, they will polarize the country, because I don't think they'll be able to do that on a unanimous vote. And if they do on a partisan vote, then the Supreme Court is going to be tarnished, probably more tarnished than it ever has been in its history. And that's going to be, you could say it's unfortunate. I don't know if it's unfortunate. I think what's important is for the American people to realize that the court is made up of human beings, and they amend the Constitution wantonly, literally, and of course there's no procedures for the people to amend the Constitution. So I think that what we need to understand is the judiciary is not a place for justice. It's a place where you get an interpretation of a law, and if the law is a bad law, you get bad interpretation as a product of that. This should be seen so Americans could grow up and realize that the judiciary is no more honored than any other American institution, and that these institutions are run by human beings, and human beings are guilty of human nature.
How do you think the American people will react to a George W. Bush presidency, whether he gets in through legislative fiat or through a stop of the vote count by the Supreme Court? What do you think the repercussions for his administration will be among just public opinion-wise? Because a lot of people say that the American people are forgiving and that they forget quickly these controversies, and a year from now this whole thing will just be an historical footnote. What do you think?
Hardly, hardly. The American people are forgiving. They've got a sense of fair play as to what should be done and how it should be done. And I think we saw that with their reaction to the impeachment process. They didn't buy into the impeachment, which they took as a witch hunt. Now, with respect to Bush getting in there, the fact that his credentials will be soiled, that the Supreme Court will be soiled, the entire institution of representative government is going to be soiled, and Bush's honeymoon is going to disappear 2 weeks before he's elected. And that would mean that it's going to be fair game with the political partisan forces to just tear each other up. And, of course, this comes at the expense of public policy. And you're not going to see much take place in the next 2 to 4 years.
That was former U.S. Senator Mike Gravel, who currently serves as the president of the group Direct Democracy. Contact Direct Democracy by visiting its website at www.philadelphiatwo.org. Whoever takes the oath of office on the steps of the Capitol this January, many citizens will view both this year's election process and the next president as lacking credibility. As the post-election dispute dragged on for more than a month, moving from courtroom to courtroom, the nation and the world were exposed to the shortcomings of the often glorified U.S. electoral system. But beyond the accounts of malfunctioning voting machines and the public shock that tens of thousands of ballots are routinely thrown out, many citizens are for the first time recognizing the systemic failures of U.S. democracy. Growing public disgust with the influence of big money in political campaigns, the limitations of our winner-take-all system, and the anti-democratic nature of the Electoral College are but a few of the issues which may resonate with citizens long after the next president takes office. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Ted Glick, national coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network. Ted describes a pro-democracy campaign motivated in part by this year's disputed presidential election and launched by a progressive coalition that recently met in Washington, D.C.
We had people from around the country, about 50 different organizations, a pretty good mix from about 20 different states, and a good representation of various third-party alternative groups and grassroots organizing efforts, progressive efforts of various kinds. And we wanted to look at where we were after the election. We thought things would be a little more settled, but they certainly aren't. We wanted to see where we were, look at a deeper level of at what the elections meant, and go from there in terms of what we should be doing. And it was a really very good meeting, very positive meeting, a lot of energy, a lot of interest in moving ahead together. One of the major decisions made was that we have basically launched a pro-democracy campaign. We think that it is just an absolutely right on time to put out alternatives to the existing electoral system in particular. We think there's a lot of issues actually as far as democracy that go beyond just the electoral system in this country, but there's a particular immediate need to focus on alternatives to the electoral system. We think large numbers of people with what's been happening in Florida are open to looking at alternatives, and irrespective really of what happened in Florida, there's been a movement growing for a number of years for a variety of different changes in the way that leaders of government, representatives that are elected to government are chosen. And we put together a Voters' Bill of Rights, a 10-point Voters' Bill of Rights that we think is very much on target in terms of what's needed, and we have begun reaching out. We're working with, again, a variety of different groups on this coming out of the meeting. We've called for a week of action in January, a pro-democracy week beginning on January 15th, which, of course, is Martin Luther King's birthday. And in many places, there will be local activities around the country on that day, and we will be bringing to many of those activities this voter bill of rights. We think it's very appropriate on that day to kick this off. And then from January 15th going up until January 20th, which, of course, is Inauguration Day, one of the things that we are urging people to consider doing locally during that period of time is teach-ins on electoral alternatives, on issues like instant runoff voting, on proportional representation, on the need to either abolish the Electoral College or changing the way electors are elected from the states to a form of proportional representation, getting big money out of politics, moving towards public financing, clean money elections, as they're called, where the private money that really corrupts and pollutes the political system is gotten rid of, as well as a number of other changes, making voting rights easier and more reliable. We saw in Florida the deliberate impediments that many of us think were established to prevent low-income people, black people in particular, from getting to vote, as well as obviously the problems in terms of the counting. There are ways that the elections can be changed so that it's much easier. For example, same-day voter registration in 44 states. If you haven't registered to vote by within about a month of the election, it's too late. And for most people, especially, of course, young people who have not registered before, most people don't get that interested in an election until the last several weeks. And in the few states where people can register to vote up to and including on the day of the election itself, usually there's much higher voter turnout. And there also is much more support, in general, for alternatives to the existing two parties. So there's more, but there are a lot of alternatives to the big money driven, winner take all electoral and a discriminatory electoral system, an electoral system in which the Democrats and Republicans run it. We're seeing that so clearly out of Florida. One of the good things about what's happening in Florida is a spotlight is being shown on the way these electoral systems function. You have Democrats and Republicans who are running the counting of the votes and the administration of the electoral system. That shouldn't be in any kind of a healthy democracy. The electoral systems should be very scrupulously nonpartisan, where you have people who are professionals in electoral administration, who are professionals in helping people vote who need to vote. That's the way the system should run, but of course it doesn't, and we think that has to change, and we think large numbers of people are ready for that, and we want to use this opening, really, this opportunity to begin to build the kind of movement can, over the next period of time, make some significant changes.
That was Ted Glick, National Coordinator of the Independent Progressive Politics Network. Contact the network by calling area code 973 1-888-338-5398 or visit its website at www.ippn.org. Taiwanese-owned Chentex factory in Managua, Nicaragua, makes blue jeans for the U.S. military and for American-based companies such as Kohl's, Target, and other large retailers. Chentex workers, paid as little as 18 cents per pair of jeans, which are sold in the U.S. for about $30, formed a union in 1998 to demand improved working conditions and a living wage. When workers asked for an 8-cent wage increase, Chentex management fired union activists and hundreds of other employees. In response, the National Labor Committee, unions, and human rights activists have organized protests at Kohl's stores and recently initiated a lawsuit in U.S. courts against Chentex parent company, Nianxing, which owns a subsidiary in Los Angeles. The court action was brought under the Alien Tort Claims Act, which has previously been used to prosecute those accused of human rights abuses and war crimes. The groups pressing the court case are hoping that the litigation, combined with growing protest actions, will force the company to reinstate its workers. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Barbara Briggs of the National Labor Committee, who describes her group's campaign to support the fired Chentex workers and how this fight relates to the larger issue of corporate globalization.
We first started looking at this factory in about 1997. When we went down with the hard copy TV program and did an expose on conditions there, absolutely god-awful. The workers were making 25 cents an hour. When they were lucky, they and their families were able to eat one meal a day. They were living, as they still live, in 9 or 10 foot by 10 foot hovels or shacks made out of concrete blocks, if they were lucky, made out of scrap tin and scrap wood and sometimes just cardboard and plastic. Dirt floors, no running water, no electricity, latrines out back or a hole in the ground out back shared by several families. Their kids were malnourished. They were malnourished. They were popping caffeine pills just to stay awake to face and cope with the incredible production quotas that they were under. They were working during busy periods, 12 and 16-hour shifts, 6 days and 7 days a week. The hard copy TV tabloid program aired at just about the same time in Nicaragua as it did in the United States, and the workers came out in the open and started organizing, and they took advantage of this incredible scandal that was, you know, occurring and that ensued in Nicaragua to organize a union. They won a first contract. They won a lot of improvements, an end to the screaming and yelling, an end to the forced overtime, which prevented a young woman worker even from going home to take care of her child at, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock at night if the child was sick. They agreed not to take a wage increase because they so much needed to put an end to the abuses and because they needed this first contract. But there was a separate letter signed that they would negotiate the much needed wage increase within a year. Well, the year came in August of last year, and the workers went back to management and said, you know, how about negotiating that wage increase? Here's our proposal. Let's sit down at the table and work on this. Management completely stonewalled. They did nothing. The workers went to the Ministry of Labor, and 3 or 4 times they formally requested mediation and that the Ministry of Labor facilitate the negotiations. Ministry of Labor did nothing. Finally, after about 9 months, the workers felt as though they had to do something stronger. And so they ran a 50-minute work stoppage from about 7 o'clock in the morning. By 8 o'clock in the morning, they were all back at their seats working. The company's response was to fire the entire union leadership. The workers were unwilling to work without their union. They went out on strike. The company's response has been to date to fire some 700 workers. The union leaders are under bogus criminal charges that could land them in jail for 20 years. And they asked for help. They desperately asked for help come spring. And we have been working with other groups around the United States, including the United Apparel Workers Union, the Steel Workers, People of Faith Network, Campaign for Labor Rights, and others. and running what I think is one of the strongest, most sophisticated corporate campaigns around the issue of global sweatshop abuses that we've seen. And it could turn out to be one of the most important ones. I mean, absolutely fascinating. There's been a popular campaign picking the corporate target, which has been Kohl's, one of the largest buyers. Hundreds of demonstrations and protests in front of Kohl's stores across the country. But there have been other elements to this campaign as well. One of them has been researching the whole corporation, looking at Nensheng as a corporation. Who are its buyers? Who are its shareholders? And now, most recently, just last week, we have launched a whole entire new phase to this campaign, focusing on U.S. military purchases from this abuser of fundamental internationally recognized human rights and workers' rights, and also helping the workers take out a lawsuit in the U.S. courts against the Taiwanese consortium that's their employer. You know, if they win the suit, U.S. courts can't order reinstatement, but they can order that damages be paid. In other words, they can win back pay, they can win punitive damages, putting pressure on this company and putting pressure on Kohl's and the U.S. retailers and the U.S. military. With all of that, we think that we should be able to help these workers win reinstatement and respect for their fundamental rights.
Barbara, how does this lawsuit under the Alien Tort Claims Act figure in with the broader struggle to incorporate labor rights into international trade agreements?
This is one way of saying we in this generation, in this next bunch of years, are going to have to come to grips with the fact that we live in a globalized economy. And right now, it's like the Wild West out there. The corporations are running from country to country in what we call a race to the bottom, looking for the best deal for themselves, which translates into the lowest wages, the least benefits, the worst working conditions, the least regulation, and essentially into the most misery. We're going to have to figure out how to regulate this newly globalized economy, how to make an even playing field so that the corporations are not competing on the basis of who can starve the workers to death, because that is what is happening right now.
That was Barbara Briggs, Senior Associate at the National Labor Committee. Contact the committee by calling area code 212-242-3002 or visit its website at www.nlcnet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Archibald Curry, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.